Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. Last month, a host of political dignitaries, including President Biden, Governor Hochul, and Senator Schumer, descended upon Syracuse to tout the federal government's $6.1 billion in grants through the CHIPS Act to Micron, which plans to build a microchip mega complex in Clay, and has said it will invest $100 billion in the project. There was, needless to say, a lot of celebration on that day. My guest today is an economic and labor geographer who's been looking at the Micron project. Todd Rutherford is a professor of geography and the environment at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship. Professor Rutherford, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Grant. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we're glad you could make it. So, as I just mentioned, you know, there are a variety of government incentives for this Micron project and $6 billion from the Federal CHIPS Act most recently, but there have been other goodies and incentives that state and local governments have been putting in as well. Could you just briefly summarize some of those?
Yeah, I mean, the CHIPS Science Act is $280 billion in total, with $39 billion allocated to supporting domestic manufacturing. And another $13 billion for research and development and workforce development. But this has, of course, been accompanied by a host of other kinds of subsidies and tax abatements and so forth like this. So I know that the county, Onondaga County's put in a fairly significant level, as well as New York State. I don't quite have the figures to hand, but it's a significant amount of money on top of that, yes.
I think it was in, you know, like almost $300 million by the time it all got added up.
If that's over a 20-year period.
Okay, that's important to note, right? It's not all up front. So thinking about that and also thinking about the promise of Micron, what people are hoping to see out of it. In one way, I guess I could say we've seen this movie before in this region, and there's even a pun in that sentence in terms of Syracuse's history on this. But it is nonetheless a case. When I talk to people around the town about Micron, a lot of them are very excited, but there are others that say, you know, they'll believe it when they see it. And so they're a little suspicious of it. Do you think that it's different this time around with Micron when it comes to helping the area economically?
Well, I think, you know, some degree of healthy skepticism is a good thing to have with respect to this. As you say, there is a history. I don't think, though, we've ever had this kind of level of federal and state commitment through the CHIPS Act, through the other kinds of interventions that are being made. So that would, what I would call, doesn't eliminate the possibilities that there are risks with this. Nothing will, but it would seem to me that this would help the project meet at least some of its at least minimal goals, if not more. Yes.
Yeah, this is kind of a more political question for you, but at least one of the things that seems different to me anyway is I get the sense that there are some pretty prominent political players that have put a lot on the line here. Yeah. I mean, you know, I mentioned Governor Hochul, Schumer, President Biden. So that to me feels a little different than maybe some of the other economic development projects. I don't know if you would feel the same way about that.
And I think that, you know, post-COVID, there's been a really strong sense in which the kind of globalization model that had been adopted from like the late 1970s onwards was clearly problematic in terms of the level of resiliency, dependency on complex overseas supply chains, all of which were, you know, on a just-in-time system. So there was no kind of room for error in them. And we found that, you know, in trying to recover from COVID in the economic sense, that these were really deeply problematic. And so there has been, I think, both an economic and political argument for reshoring on top of this longer term concern about the level of investments that's required to sustain a viable manufacturing base in the United States.
Yeah, so the country itself has a stake in this project, yeah. I guess, as opposed to, say, the film hub or the mall. I was wondering, in addition to the confidence level in the project actually happening, which is what you've just been speaking to a little bit, from an economic standpoint and a governmental tax standpoint, are there reasons to think that we'll see the government, and therefore, you know, we the people of Onondaga County, I guess, we'll get our money back from these upfront investments?
Yeah. I mean, let's assume that the number of jobs, direct jobs, that are said to be created over this next 20-year period are created. So there's something that we economic geographers talk about, multiplier effects. And that is, for every direct dollar spent in a sector, how many other indirect spendings and jobs can be linked to it. And manufacturing tends to have a fairly high level of multipliers, like, I know the auto industry in particular, but also chip manufacturing. So if we say that we're going to get 9,000 direct jobs, as is forecast in this project with Micron, then we're looking up to an additional 40,000 more jobs being created. And so if we're anywhere near that figure, then it will pay back, just in terms of the multipliers of spending, of tax revenue, and so forth. Yes.
Yeah, those number of those jobs is really mind-boggling when you think of the size of Syracuse.
Yeah. Assuming that we get anywhere near those jobs, that's the big thing. Yeah.
Important assumption. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Syracuse University Geography Professor Todd Rutherford, and we're discussing the Micron Project in Central New York. So based on your research, Todd, and the things that you've looked at and thought about, what are your biggest concerns about the economic aspects of this project as you look at it right now?
Well, when we have to remember that this is a very cyclical industry, and so it's very difficult to forecast in any 1 year or even a 5 year period, you know, exactly if jobs will be created or if jobs that are created don't simply result in layoffs. So we need to be prepared for thinking about the cyclical nature of the industry, even one that's getting the level of subsidy that it's getting. The other thing that I'm somewhat concerned about on the kind of economic front is, you know, who's going to be responsible for training and doing those kinds of things? Because it seems to me that the model that the United States has followed for about the last 50 years is increasingly employers expect either the public sector through the education or some other body to do the training. And so it seems to me that there is this expectation, and simply this is certainly happening in the local economy, where, you know, Onondaga College and Syracuse University are stepping up the amount of investment. And I'm not necessarily against that, but we do have to ask, you know, whose responsibility is it to make somebody job ready? Where does the public sector's responsibility and the employer's responsibility begin? And it seems like for a long time, the kinds of training that used to be done internally are now expected to be done either by the individual coming into the job or through the public education system. And so if Micron and other companies are gaining this level of subsidy, is it not fair to expect that they should also pick up more of the training? And that's not clear to me that that's going on.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, and I wanted to ask you about that. What happens if, okay, OCC and SU and, you know, maybe Lemoyne and other schools around here create programs, and then Micron says, after they encounter these people, well, they're really not quite what we need. We're going to have to hire from overseas, or we're going to have to pull people over from Idaho or something. I mean, is that what happens then? Is that just the company's decision? Or,
well, I mean, and again, we're not sure exactly what the agreement says about those aspects. Assuming that it's just simply the company's decision to make, then yes, they could bring in people on visa. They can bring non-domestic workers, or they can bring people in from other locations. So that is a concern, in the sense that we're not sure about what the responsibility of Micron should be in terms of doing that kind of training. My other concern is that, you know, if you build this training infrastructure and the jobs don't appear, what's going to happen? There has been some reports from Arizona recently that they're stepping up these trainings and apprenticeships and other kinds of programs for the chip companies that are coming there. But the hiring hasn't really gone on to nearly the extent that they expected at this point. It may yet come to fruition, but it seems to me that, you know, the risk is kind of on the public and the individual worker to invest in skills and then hope that that's exactly what the firm wants. And it seems to me that there should be some levers of intervention within any kind of agreement that says, you know, you have some responsibilities. We can't train everybody down to the last bolt to tighten and screw to screw in, right? You know, you've got to do something on this. You know?
Yeah, on that issue of the levers, are based on your experience and your research, are there like best practices for that the government or you know policy instruments that could speak to that?
Yeah, well, there does seem to be some local community benefit agreements that have occurred in other communities that have who have companies receiving chip grants, and these tend to be coalitions of local labor unions and community groups, and they were stipulating things about minority hires, a union neutrality agreements, and other kinds of things. And, you know, there's stipulations within, for example, the Federal CHIPS Act about not engaging in stock buybacks. That is, you know, using the money that you get from the CHIPS Act, from the public, to effectively just simply inflate your shares by buying stocks. And it's not clear that this is being enforced. So we have the letter of the law, and then we have the fact of the law. And it seems to me that so far there's some discrepancy, and I'm not sure who's making that decision. And it's partly in the sense that there's different layers of responsibility here. So the CHIPS Act is passed by executive and by the U.S. government, but it's enforced by the Commerce Department, and the Commerce Department may have other priorities. So it's not clear that's going on in the same way.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Todd Rutherford. He's a professor in the Geography and the Environment Department at Syracuse University's Maxwell School. And we've been discussing the Micron project here in central New York. So obviously one of the big things that I have read about this project when it comes to the jobs is that in addition to creating a lot of jobs, and you mentioned that multiplier effect in the first half of the program, which again is just an astonishing number when you think of the size of the area, but that many of these jobs that Micron is going to be providing are going to be very high paying relative to the Syracuse market, the current set of jobs in the area. And I was just wondering, What effects will that have? Obviously, it's going to have some huge effects on the labor market here in central New York. And it's just kind of hard to think that through. What do you see happening in terms of ripple effects or broader impacts to the labor market here?
Well, there's a number of different ways to address this. First of all, we need to look at the fact that the types of jobs that are being created, there's differences in terms of pay and skill level. I mean, obviously, you have people who are graduate engineers, but then about 60% of the workforce, I believe, will be what we call technical workers. The graduate engineers are going to be earning significantly above the average for the predicted pay, but the technical staff will probably be earning maybe 50 to 60,000 a year, which, maybe $20 to $25 an hour, give or take more with overtime and other kinds of things. So it's a kind of skewed or bifurcated labor market. Let's assume the number of jobs that are being created at the level of wages and salaries that are predicted. obviously this is going to have these ripple effects. They can be very beneficial in the sense that, you know, workers' wages in the United States and elsewhere have been fairly stagnant for 40 years, and including in Syracuse. So there'd be probably actually a good thing that wages are going to go up. But, you know, on the other hand, you can have things going on like what they call poaching, where a big firm like Micron can fulfill its skill needs by just simply taking a worker from an already an existing firm that's done the training and so forth like this, but can't afford to necessarily bump up the pay to the level that Micron is offering. And so then you can have skill shortages that can come out of that. And so that becomes a potential issue in terms of how that affects the labor market. But, you know, especially if you also have more equitable and diverse hiring, we have an opportunity here for, you know, minorities and other groups in the Syracuse region that have not been included in a lot of what we will call good paying jobs to have access to these jobs. But again, it has to be there has to be benchmarks set by the community. There is an advisory board, but these benchmarks have some teeth, and in terms of maybe holding back certain subsidies if they're not being fulfilled. So it's not simply up to Micron. It's also the community should have some levers into this particular impact. Yes.
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because one lever that I was struck by, and it's not doesn't really fit the categories you've mentioned so far exactly, but I watched the announcement of the $6 billion, and where again President Biden, Governor Hochul, Senator Schumer, among other elected officials, spoke, and I was struck by how much was being made about unions during all of that. Mm-hmm. Every single speaker hit that point hard about the value of unions, the fact that these would be, they kept talking about union jobs, and they made it sound like most of the jobs at the new manufacturing plant would be unionized, except I was left a little confused. Were they talking about the unionization of the construction of the plant, or were they talking about both the construction of the plant and the operation of the plant? Anyway, what's your sense? I mean, how many of these jobs are going to be unionized? Which ones will be unionized? Do we know?
The only thing that I do know is that they have an agreement to only hire union labor for the construction phase. Okay. I don't think there's any other understanding beyond that. And that's why in other communities there are, especially ones that are getting CHIPS money, but other kinds of infrastructure money, there have been agreements to have a union neutrality. That is, if Micron and a union wants to form there, that they're not going to hold compulsory one-on-one anti-union meetings. They won't engage in arbitrary firings or intimidation of the workforce. They will agree to be neutral during that process. And certainly there have been other agreements in New York State between, for example, the Communication Workers of America and General Electric, which is also receiving some infrastructure and green infrastructure money for those kinds of things. So it's not clear that there will be necessarily a union at all. The point is that if workers wanted to have one, will they be able to make a truly free choice in order to do that?
Well, let me push you a little bit on this, and I'm kind of pushing you into your values a bit, I suppose. But, you know, Micron is this really high-tech company. Do you think it's important that a lot of the jobs there at the plant are unionized, in your view?
Well, I go back to, I feel that there needs to be a real choice made by the workers. It's ultimately up to the employees themselves to make that decision. But, you know, my values would be that there is some important features of unionization when unions work well, of giving workers a voice in the workplace. Also, unions are positively associated with things like investment and training. They often make firms do more training than they would normally do otherwise. They also reduce the level of employee turnover in plants. So they build kind of the human capital that comes by through learning by doing. So, you know, in my view, there's a lot of positives that come out of unionization. And I do believe it would be a positive benefit to the workers there. But as I said, ultimately, it's their choice to make.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Syracuse University professor Todd Rutherford. Well, let me stick with the unionization just a little bit longer. Do you happen to know whether Micron itself has a particular history so far? Have they been friendly to unions, unfriendly, anything else that you're aware of?
I must confess my ignorance here. I don't know what their history has been. You know, traditionally the semiconductor industry is not particularly friendly to unions. Okay, like a lot of the high tech industry. That's slowly changing in some areas. There are some unions in associated with high tech industries more generally. But the one reason that they've offshored over those years, the last 40 years, is to avoid in some cases union labor or paying levels of wages that are typically associated with not just unions but U.S. standards.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. No, I wondered about that as well. Well, you mentioned something at the beginning of our conversation about the investments that educational institutions like OCC and Syracuse University, and I believe I read about also some things that were going to be done at the high school level, even about this, to get the students ready to go in to those programs. And so it does seem that these institutions are making some upfront investments now in their curriculums and their programs, and particularly in the STEM areas. And I believe, if my understanding of what I heard in a faculty meeting was correct, that I believe that Syracuse University has actually reallocated some faculty lines to reflect this. So they're making some real decisions about this.
Yes.
Just your sense, is that too risky at this point? Is this necessary now to do this?
They may be privy to more. They may be privy to more information than I have. So it is something of a risk in the sense that there is no guarantee that the number of jobs that are pledged to be created will be created. And there's no guarantee that those workers will stay in the Syracuse region, whether they're skilled engineer graduates of Syracuse University or whether they're graduating from OCC. I will say that especially for the technical level, it's very important that if any investment is made in training, that workers are receiving a recognized transferable skill. That is, that it's not just simply to the demands of Micron, but are skills that can be transferred to other firms in the region, hopefully that the people can stay in the region, assuming that happens, so that it's not just simply a skill that is either linked to Micron or is completely unrecognized elsewhere. So, and I do believe OCC is trying to make sure that they are, and as a public institution, they should be. But it is really important that if you are going to make these investments, you can't guarantee exactly that they're going to get those jobs, but you can at least say they've got a transferable skill that could go to another firm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's an important point. Well, we got about 3 minutes left or so, and I wanted to give you a bit of time to discuss this final question. And I wanted to get, you've looked at a lot of these kinds of things in the past in other industries, and you've looked at Micron now a little bit. From your particular perspective and your perch, what do you think are the most important questions that the people who are listening to this program, mm-hmm. The citizens of the region, should have at the front of their minds as they're thinking about this? Because again, some of these numbers are just mind-blowing, and I think the I wouldn't necessarily call it a danger, but maybe it's a danger. But I think the inclination is just to say, oh, we have to have this. You know, this is just, these are numbers I've never contemplated before. Mm-hmm. So, but what do you think people here should be have at the front of their minds as they're processing this in the next few years?
Well, you know, as I said, this is an equal parts an opportunity and a risk. I think people here should be thinking about an opportunity in the sense of developing also a supply base that is not just simply wedded to Micron, but has possibilities of developing its own synergies with other firms, supply elsewhere. And so that we're not just putting all our eggs in one basket with Micron, that we develop a kind of momentum that this kind of investment will generate, but not just simply to say we're just only going to supply to Micron, but to develop independent capabilities in terms of research and development and other kind of capacities that will allow a kind of cluster to develop here that isn't just dependent on Micron, so that we have a more diversified base. I think that that's critical. I haven't talked about that so much, but I think that's also very critical to have here.
Just a few seconds left and maybe taking you out of your lane here, but one of the things that I've noticed just since this announcement has been made is the value of my home has gone up considerably. And a lot of people are excited about that, particularly in my neighborhood. But there's a downside to that if that continues, and that's affordability of housing. And it's already an issue in Syracuse. So just in a couple seconds, is that a big problem we ought to be thinking about too?
In the short to medium term, you know, housing is not something that responds very well to market changes. So the supply isn't going to necessarily match the demand if the demand comes to fruition, of course. And so we need to think about how we're going to have affordable housing, and the public sector and private sector need to make some agreements on that too.
Well, we'll have to see how it all plays out. That was Todd Rutherford. Professor Rutherford, thanks again for taking the time to talk with me. It's been very informative.
Well, you're very welcome, Grant. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, conversations in the public interest, is hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio. Assistant producer is Jacqueline Witwicky, and the program is edited by Mark Lefonier. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program and hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/campbellconversations.